Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Today we're at the University of Canberra to talk to Professor Ken Coates, who's an historian and holds the Canada Research Chair in Regional Innovation in Saskatchewan. He's in Canberra to deliver a lecture about how the university sector can prepare students for a future that will see the rise of automation and artificial intelligence. With the federal government still to produce its long-awaited, revamped higher education policy, these issues are very topical here in Australia. Ken Coates, your lecture is titled Universities 2050, Skills, Jobs, Learning and the Changing World of 21st Century Universities. Look into the crystal ball and tell us what a typical university will look like in 2050.
So if my guess is right, there will no longer be a typical university. And if you look right now, you would see that here at the University of Canterbury, we could easily be at the University of Calgary in Canada or University of Saskatchewan or any one of 100 universities in Britain. And they look pretty much the same. They have very much the same range of courses, the same structures, the same formats, slight variations here and there. I think by the year 2050, we're going to have dozens and dozens, hundreds in fact, of much more specialized institutions, more boutique institutions. We'll have a smaller number of what we call these multiversities, the large scale enterprises that have the 30, 40, 50,000 students offering everything to everybody. I think we're going to see a much larger shift toward private education, a huge shift toward work-embedded education where the workforce is constantly being retrained and re-educated based on sort of new realities. And we're going to see a situation where my guess is that we'll have a sort of a smaller percentage of the population in universities and more of them in technical institutes, training centers, short course programs and things of that sort. So we'll still have universities, we'll have those brilliant places where great students come together with great faculty members and just talk about the grand ideas. But I think we're probably going to look back on somewhere around this time, 2015, 2020, and say those were the big days. Those were the days when things were really growing like crazy and we had sort of could never do much that was wrong.
Well, in that case, what challenges do you see on the horizon for graduates? Because if we have these specialised institutions and people go through and do a fairly targeted course, but then during their working life have to change occupations, where does that leave them?
Well, it leaves them right now with a huge dose of what I call career paranoia. Parents don't know what's going to happen. Kids don't know what's going to happen. And in fact, you said, you know, sort of reflect for where the things are going. Well, actually, the problems are already here. We have significant challenges in different countries with the unemployment of university graduates. It's very high in places like Spain and Greece and other countries. We have a larger problem with graduate underemployment, people who are, they get a job, but the job actually doesn't require a university degree, but at least they're employed, so it's something. But they're not getting a career job, they're not getting the security that they thought they would deserve and would earn as they go along. So we don't have to wait to see what the problem is. The problem's kind of here now. And I think when you add underemployment and unemployment together with the more shocking statistic, which is the number of kids who don't finish university. So in Australia, the actual number is a third. You know, over 30% of the students who start a three or four year program, honors program, don't finish even in 5 years. So put those things together and say, okay, the number one outcome is actually not finishing. The second outcome is finishing and being sort of underemployed. And the third one is being, the third one is actually getting a decent job. And the fourth one is actually being unemployed. We're actually in that challenge already without even acknowledging it and realizing that it's there. So in North America, there's a huge habit of recycling. So you go and get a degree and then you go back to a college and get a technical certificate, maybe become a radiation therapist. One of my scariest days was a very angry university student who'd gotten a four-year degree, spent a lot of money, spent 2 years trying to find a job, and went back and trained as a dental technician, and she was taking out her anger on the person, me, who was sitting in the dental chair. And this was not the job she wanted.
That would be very awkward. quite scary.
Those instruments were sharp, and she was pressing really hard. And so I think you know, we're already in this kind of a challenge. And the problem we have is that in almost all the Western countries, governments face one demand, and that is to expand accessibility, as though that's some great nirvana. It's the ticket to the middle class. Give everybody a chance to go to university. And so in my view, it's not a very popular one sometimes. I think the doors are too wide open. When you have 31% of the people, 33%, not finishing their degree, we're not selecting them properly. We're not making sure they're motivated to be there. So we already have that problem about those employment sort of issues down the line. Now we're starting to get where the workforce is changing. People, the number of jobs in accounting will drop. The number of jobs in the law are starting to drop very dramatically. We're losing retail jobs, banking jobs, very serious challenges.
Are you saying that as societies, Western societies, we're getting to be overeducated?
So I would differentiate in the sense that you can never be overeducated. You should always be learning, always studying and whatever. I think we're over-credentialed. And those aren't the same thing. You can go to a university and get a credential and not be very well educated, depending on how much time you spend in your work and whether you study hard and do all those sorts of things. I think we're over-credentialed in the wrong areas. And I think it's also fair, don't want to sound like the universities are the sole problem here. I think one of the issues is we have too few good jobs. So it's actually a function of the fact that we're losing jobs on the left hand, we're overproducing people for jobs that no longer exist on the other hand, and you're creating a growing level of dissatisfaction, sometimes anger. And if you realize that the role that unemployed university graduates played in Arab Spring, for example, these are people who did exactly what they were told. Go to university, get a training, become an engineer, become a financial person, get out and get a really good job, and the jobs don't show up. And now you have people who are educated, who are articulate, who know about the world and wondering why they're not participating in the benefits of the time. They get kind of upset, and that's where you get pushback against government. At the other extreme, you see a situation in the United States where a fairly substantial number of people who lost their jobs because of economic change, very frustrated by the uncertainty, wondering who's looking out for the middle class, that kind of rhetoric become very powerful now. And I think we're using a 1980s and 90s solution to try to solve a 21st century problem.
Do you believe the universities have become or are becoming just factories to turn out graduates?
Well, my friend and I wrote a book on this in North America, and we called it Dream Factories, because I think what happens is they're marketing a dream. And it's a very simple one. Come to university, get a four-year degree, and when you come off the graduation podium, stand there and somebody will offer you a job. It's just, this is your guaranteed way to get into the middle class and to have a good career. And I think universities have been under enormous pressure to do that. They've overpromised. Universities are very good at overpromising, both for the students and on the research side. So they are producing lots of students. The other part of the word you use is actually really upsetting to me. Not because you used it, but this idea of factory. Factory is a process. It's where you bring lots of raw material in, you grind it up in a very structured, formal kind of way, and you spit out a product out the other end. And there's two problems with this. Number one is when you have universities that have huge first-year classes. At the University of Toronto, they have classes of 1,000 students or 2,000 students in big, huge lecture halls. That is a factory setting. That's not an educational setting. That's moving people through the system. The problem out the other side is that a factory actually produces things of shared quality. So if you get a car, a Toyota vehicle, it should be a Toyota vehicle. One shouldn't have three wheels and the other one have four wheels. They should all be roughly the same. We're having a problem with the output. The output's very, very inconsistent. So we're now getting a larger and larger number of companies who are not using a university degree as a sifting tool, a filter. Used to be able to say, we need a job, we need somebody who's smart, articulate, hardworking, dedicated, and committed, let's hire a university student. Because they've shown that commitment to their own studies, their own personal development, their career progress. They've demonstrated that they can do this in a very systematic way. Now when you hire university graduates in many countries, they're saying, we're not so sure we're going to get that. Maybe they can't write effectively. Maybe their work ethic is really questionable because they strung a three-year degree out for 5 years. You know, maybe they didn't learn as much as we thought because they've been in these huge classes without a lot of contact with professors. So I think the factory sort of metaphor is apt at one level, the dream factory idea. Let's bring people in and we'll push them through and we'll get them out into society in a big way. But I don't think the parents, young people, or even universities are really thinking very carefully about what that job market looks like in 2050.
But if you narrow down what the universities are producing with more specialisation and so on, as you're saying the trend is, don't you make people less flexible and don't you make them less educated in the broad sense, which might be important for a good life to have that broad education?
So I'm a huge fan of a broad education. We have a problem, particularly in North America, where people don't read very much anymore. And when I come to Australia or New Zealand, I love to go out just to see the number of bookstores. They're all over the place. In Canada, the bookstores are closing like crazy. And we have very few public, you know, private bookstores in the way we used to have them only 15 or 20 years ago. So I think I'm a huge fan of the general education. I'm not sure that a lot of university programs give that even now. It's not a question of, again, 50 years to 20 years down the line. We have an awful lot of students in North America heading to business schools. They're studying marketing. Now, is marketing a good liberal arts education that introduces you to ethical issues and moral issues and historical backgrounds? Not particularly. Same with the applied sciences. They're wonderful degrees, but sometimes they have very small, what they used to call breadth requirements. Take one humanities course, one social science course. That hasn't been a really good, well-rounded education for quite some time. So we already have that challenge. What I actually see is coming down the line is we'll probably have, I think, a smaller number of people going to universities right out of high school. Will be more selective. They will get a good foundational education. And then as they go through their adult life, the job market will change and their career opportunities will change. And they'll get, rather than the 2 and 4 year and 3 year degrees and the graduate degrees, they'll actually be using universities for short courses to update and upgrade from a change will happen in the finance sector. And somebody will come and say, boy, our big market now is China. Go back and take a 4 month program, intensive program on what's going on in the Chinese marketplace, and then come back and ready to work again. So it's that kind of a transition. And the universities have high level knowledge. They have the research base, the really well-founded sort of preparation for things like that.
What effect do you think the commercialization of education, if I can put it that way, has had? Here, people pay thousands of dollars for courses where some decades ago they were free.
The commercialization of education is a fascinating question, and I always use the example in North America where my daughter, when she goes to university, I will save money because she's a ballerina. And so I pay a huge amount of money for her to be a ballerina. When she stops, university will be cheap because of the tax breaks and things associated with it. And so, you know, I don't think of education for upper middle class families as actually very inexpensive. It's extremely expensive for people from working class backgrounds, and that's the group that's actually seen their participation rate drop up quite dramatically. I'm very worried about that. Smart kids from poor families should be able to go to university without the financial burdens.
But does it also have the effect of making the students very demanding?
Well, absolutely right. I mean, when the university refers to students as clients, the students will behave like clients. When the students feel, I have paid for my education, or even worse in North America, you get a lot of parents phoning up. I've paid for my daughter's education. I want you to do this for me. So, of course, you create this consumerist environment. I've had students from really high-quality American universities in programs, study abroad programs, and they'll walk into you and say, my parents aren't paying $45,000 a year for me to fail. I said, no, you're right, you know, but you did it by yourself. You don't have to pay for it. You failed that course by yourself. You better pick up your boots and get working on this. But so this, I think it does create a real problem that way.
But this does put pressure on staff, doesn't it? Especially, for example, students from overseas. If they come in, they're paying a lot. It's difficult to maintain high standards when the client group is very, very demanding.
So if you watch what's happened with international education in Australia, which is a very big part of the Australian economy, 25% of all your university students, you have a very, very worrisome rate of people graduating from a degree in Australian university without English competency skills. Similar problems in Canada and the United States, similar problems in England. And part of it is, you know, I've seen notes from, not at my university, but notes from deans basically saying, you know, stop failing these students. We need the money. Basically, keep them in course. You know, give them a low grade, but just don't give them a failing grade because we have to keep them coming back for next year. So it does raise the expectations on the pressure on the faculty. It is producing the income that allows them to pay high salaries for faculty members and keep the class sizes relatively small. We have another problem, I think, that's related to this. in that we're handling all the influx of students largely by hiring what we call conditional staff or adjunct professors or sessional lecturers, and so those folks don't have the time. They're being paid to teach a course and get $6,000 a course. They don't have the time to do remedial education with 87 students in their class. So the model we're setting up right now is not one that will design to get the students well trained and prepared for a very competitive workforce.
Well, is there an obligation on academics to push back against this and say standards are very important and we need to somehow deal with this problem?
So standards are absolutely critical. If you should not graduate a student that is not capable of writing and reading and communicating and articulating their ideas. Academics are under a lot of pressure to do other things, scholarly papers, grant applications, and things of that. This is only one part of the sort of questions in front of them. And some faculties hold up to this. Interestingly, the faculties and the programs that are best at this are the ones that are externally accredited. So a medical degree, a nursing degree, an engineering program, where you can get your degree, but you don't pass until the profession says you've passed, they're actually holding it up because you're embarrassed. If you were a history professor and you passed a whole bunch of students who actually couldn't write very well, and then after they finished, they had to go write a history exam organized by the American or Canadian or Australian Historical Association, and your students failed, you'd pick it up pretty quickly. So the engineers teach toward those standards. But we don't actually have official standards in many of our programs. Australian, New Zealand universities do a bit better of comparing between themselves. We don't do very much of that in Canada. So absolutely, I'm actually really saddened because a lot of companies now are not using university education and university credential as a filter. And they used to use it as a filter because they knew the students had those core abilities, and now they don't. And that actually is extremely worrisome.
Now, you've been interested in the trends in artificial intelligence and automation. What do you think these will mean for the workforces in the decades ahead?
So this whole issue of automation, artificial intelligence, digital technology, robotification have a lot of people very worried, but not enough. So the estimates are that depending on which economy you're in, 30 to 50% of the jobs we currently have would disappear somewhere by 2025, 2030. That's not that long down the line. And automated trucks, for example, or automated taxis have the chance to get rid of thousands of jobs. Most people in our modern society are very effective job killers. So they're using online banking, for example, and using it very, very extensively. They're actually using all sorts of new technologies to buy music or to buy books or whatever. None of this needs human intervention at all. We are only at the beginning stage of that. So now we're actually seeing that the legal profession is under big challenges. Things you used to hire junior lawyers to help with, that stuff happens in computers in nanoseconds. It's gonna happen to medicine. Is already happening in medicine in certain ways. It's already affecting accounting in a major, major way. So these used to be these great, secure, wonderful professions, and we're going to see the number of jobs slip and slide. The banking industry, through what they call fintech, been able to lay off thousands of people around the world because they don't no longer need somebody to sit at a counter and actually give you your money back. You have an ATM machine or you do it on your cell phone. So as we see these things come through, we're going to see a lot of jobs disappear. What we don't know is what's going to come in their stead. So now if these companies aren't hiring something, you're not hiring people to do the work that they usually were doing, are new companies going to come up doing other things? And what are those things? And how do you prepare for them? We actually don't know. So when it's really interesting, when you get to the end of these books and everybody's writing these books about the displacement and the second machine age and all these kinds of really interesting things, and they say at the end, what do we do about it? That is actually where the global conversation about a guaranteed annual income has really picked up speed. It used to be a kind of a marginal left-wing kind of idea that sort of found a certain amount of currency in places like Scandinavia. Now people are talking about all over the place.
Explain that concept.
Those guaranteed annual income is the government basically says you're going to get paid a living wage whether you're able to find work or not. And the idea is that you have to keep money flowing through the economy. So if 45% of the population have no jobs and are sitting there not doing anything, they're sitting at home, sort of in self-destructive behavior probably, give them a decent income, let them volunteer, let them, but give them money to spend on clothes, money to spend on trips, so that they actually have an opportunity to participate in the
economy. This would be a huge change in mindset, well, certainly for a country like Australia and for for most comparable countries.
It would be a staggering change. So Finland's actually experimenting with this, but they're experimenting on the very tiny margins with people who have really basically no income now. They're going to give them sort of, when they call it a living wage, it's bare living wage. You start contemplating what this might mean sort of 40 years from now in Australia, where you say, all right, we are going to have jobs for 55% of the working age workforce. So we're going to find 45, we're going to pay basic incomes to 45%. What do you do? Well, so Bill Gates, for example, recommended that you put a tax on robots so that robots have to pay income tax. If they're displacing work, everybody who installs a robot has to pay a certain more tax. Well, they're not going to make them do that in China or Taiwan. They're going to make them do that in Malaysia. So what you're going to be is uncompetitive. And you'll lose even more jobs. So we don't know where this is going. I think the idea of paying people a decent salary so they can actually contribute to society is a great idea. In fact, I would say in Australia and Canada are two of the best countries in the world at this. We created extremely successful societies by giving high-paying labor, high-paying salaries to people who had average or below average skills. They were just construction workers and people who drove trucks at mines and all these sort of post office workers in Canada. A post office worker in Canada gets $70,000 a year. It only takes an hour or two to train them how to do their job. That they were able to live well. That's a middle class income. They do really well. We're moving into a situation where those jobs are disappearing like crazy. We use email instead of sending mail. They're laying off thousands of workers as a consequence. And the factories that are closing down, you no longer manufacture automobiles here very much, if at all. And those are jobs that people were just assembly line jobs. Decent jobs for decent people, hardworking, honorable people of integrity. But the job's gone. So instead of in Canada being paid $30 an hour in benefits, you're now working for $12 an hour and no benefits. So you can barely keep you're probably having to sell your house, probably selling your car. That's not the lifestyle that you'd anticipated. So, and the kids who are coming up, they said, well, I went to, dropped out of grade 10, went and worked in the factory, you should do the same thing. Well, you can't anymore. Those jobs aren't there. So I am very concerned about this because I do not think we're going to have this grand humanitarian impulse that leads us to accept for myself a 50% of my current standard of living so that an unemployed worker now gets the same standard of living that I have. That's a humanitarian sort of instinct that I don't see very prominently in the Western world.
And it sounds a quite alarming prospect.
We should all be thinking about this very, very carefully. People have been talking about this for 30 years.
But as you say, there are no obvious answers, because even if you give a guaranteed income, it's going to be at a lower standard of living, and the people are perhaps going to have more leisure than they know what to do with.
And the lower standard of living for the rest of the working people will have to pay for the lower standard of living for the other folks, right? And then the other question here, sort of traditional economists say, don't worry. We've been through this before. Agriculture used to be 80% of the North American workforce. Now it's 2%. We found jobs for them in the factories. And when factory workers first got started, we killed all of the guild workers, the highly skilled, specialized craftspeople. Well, guess what happened? We found new jobs for those. So
something will turn up economics.
Something, exactly. And I'm just not a fan of that. Because first off, I'm an historian by training. And when that happens, you have 20 or 30 years of excruciating difficulty. People forced off the farms, living in poverty, desperately going into the cities, that sort of thing. And we also deal with the fact that in North America right now, and in Australia and other places, your competitors are emerging economies. They're actually the Thailands of the world and the Indias of the world, and they're operating in a much more intensely competitive environment. So I'm very concerned about this. I'll take a really easy example of something like journalism. We now have computers that actually write news stories. So, for example, in baseball games, what happens is they feed the scorecard into the computer, and this computer writes the story. And it shows up there, and it looks like a regular story, and it's written like a regular story, and the computer wrote it for you. Well, that's a good job for a starting journalist, and that's gone now. And then you add in the fact that people don't read anymore and the journalists lost their job anyway. So these are complications that aren't very pleasant to think about.
I think we'll move off this depressing area very quickly. It's far too close to home. If we could just at the end turn to your country, you've got a progressive government, and of course Canada's dealing with the Trump phenomenon, really cheek by jowl. Do you think that progressive politics in Canada will come under a lot of pressure in the next few years. The Trudeau government at the moment seems to be doing well, am I right?
The Trudeau government's been surprisingly successful. He actually came in with fairly low expectations. He was charismatic and he was good looking and he liked to take selfies. And so people kind of teased him a little bit about what he was going to do. They've actually done relatively well. They're running up more of a deficit than they sort of promised. They said we're going to go $10 billion in deficit. It's $30 billion now after in the first year alone. So there's some sort of uncertainty there. We do have a Conservative Party that's looking for a leader, and there are a couple of people in there who are, one who is a sort of a Trump-like business person who's never been a politician, another who is sort of on the sort of Canadian nationalist front, protect ourselves against immigrants and what have you. Canada's very much like Australia in this regard. About 30 to 35% of our population is new Canadian and their children. We're already there as to a mixed economy and mixed society. So if somebody wants to come in and be anti-immigrant, they're not going to be elected. They might get some seats in certain parts of the country that are overwhelmingly European and Caucasian, but they're not going to do very well in the cities, and the cities are what drives our economy now as we sort of go forward. Canada also very much likes being the anti-America, always has been. America's militaristic, we're not. America's, you know, nationalistic, we're not. America now is perceived as being sort of anti-immigrant. Hey, we're not. You know, if you followed when the first Syrian refugees came to Canada, we committed ourselves to 25,000 people coming into the country.
And the Prime Minister went and met some, didn't he?
He went to the airport when they first came in and he brought winter jackets for them because they were coming out of Syria into very difficult circumstances. However, because there are financial challenges, we haven't spending the money we set aside to help them with their adaptation to Canada. So they've come here, they're happy to be here, they're safe, but they're having trouble getting English language courses, they aren't getting job training programs. So I think, in fact, Canada is doing quite well. There's two countries in the world I think the rest of the world is extremely envious about, and that's Canada and Australia. We have great countries, we're very decent people, Canadians are nice, Australians are loud. We have these two wonderful countries that share an awful lot in common. And I think in the United States, the excesses of President Trump, and that's how people perceive them in Canada, are actually very strong reasons to become more Canadian. And I worry a little bit that what will happen is in the past with Richard Nixon, a certain part of the America during the war in Vietnam, we actually became sanctimonious. And we were among the world's leading sanctimonious nations, if there is such a rating. And I'm worried that that's what's going to happen. We have the similar sort of dislocated lower middle class. We have a similar process underway in Canada. We have big parts of the country where people are losing their jobs and not much of a sense of opportunity. That group, which we caused, basically contributed, not wasn't the whole reason, to the rise of President Trump. We actually have that element there. And so rather
than... But still very small?
No, it's not. Actually, whole regions, rural Quebec, the Maritime provinces, is actually quite substantial. Alberta was a powerhouse for many years based on oil and gas. Prices are way down. The climate change advocates are punishing Alberta right now. And so we've got a province that used to have no unemployment, you know, is now up to 11%. And so those folks are people who were making $110,000 a year driving a dump truck. And now they're unemployment insurance. And they're saying that the government of Canada is not talking about us. And that's the same sort of rhetoric that got Hillary Clinton in trouble and got Obama in trouble, is that you're not looking out for our interests. I can see that happening.
So you're saying there are two trends at work. On the one hand, the sort of forces that led to the Trump rise. On the other hand, the historical forces that say, well, let's be different from the United States. Let's, in this case, stay progressive.
Yep.
Which do you think will win out in the end?
I think the progressive side will win out because, in fact, even those people who are being dislocated, we have a much more humane and straightforward social welfare system. We don't do stamps, food stamps. We don't sort of have the workfare mentality in the same sort of way that you see in a lot of American states. And so we're kind of gentle. And in the sense that we have a good social safety net, people tend not to lose their homes. When they lose their jobs, their income stays fairly high for quite a while. When they run out of unemployment insurance claims, we'll put them in a training program. So they'll get paid while they go to school and get those. So we have that sort of impulse within the country sort of as a whole. And we actually have a fairly substantial growing experience of inequality. where the city of Toronto, for example, an average home is costing $2 million. In Vancouver, in the city of Vancouver, an average home is $3 million. And so we already have this inequality sort of in front of us, but it hasn't really taken deep root, because we have a lot of smaller towns where things are more equal, a lot of parts of the country where it's kind of bad form to be rich. So, you know, I come from a province called Saskatchewan, which is sort of like the agricultural parts of South Australia. It's lovely home, you know, really fundamental, down-to-earth kind of people, you know, having good lives. And there, it's kind of really bad form to buy a really fancy pickup truck and put big horns and whistles on it and drive around with flash wheels. So people don't do that. And so you don't live the inequality. We don't have gated communities in Canada, or almost none, where people sort of hide behind, you know, protected walls. So we're a gentler country that way, and I think we're more concerned about other folks. Where there's a challenge, and this is the one to watch, because I've watched for a number of years the situation on Nauru and the placement of immigrants into these camps in Christmas Island and places like that. And that's always been, I think, a knife in the conscience of Australia. What's happening, and it was going to happen now, is that people are fleeing the United States because they know they can't stay. Whereas before, the immigration people weren't chasing people down. Now they've taken the limits off. Basically, if you know somebody's here illegally, throw them out if you want to, if you think they should go. And so these immigration agents, they've known these people for years, and they were told by the Obama administration, don't press those issues. Unless they're criminals, unless they're causing disruption, just don't press it. Now what's happening is some of these folks are saying, we better get out of here. So they're starting to show up in Canada, and they're showing up in Canada in a dribble. But if the dribble becomes a bit of a torrent, and if it becomes a bit of a flood, then Canadians are going to be, it's easy to be sanctimonious and self-righteous, saying we're nicer, we bring in 25,000 Syrians. If all of a sudden we've got Somali refugees coming across the border in large numbers, and we turn them back and send them not to us, the United States, but maybe back to Africa, that's really going to cause a grief. And just to give you an example, Canada can be a little bit colder than Australia, as you probably know. So the last little while, it's been 25 and 30 degrees below zero, which is what makes us strong, tall, and handsome. But it's cold. We've had people who've been showing up at the Canadian border, and you can just literally walk across the border. All you have to do is go down a side road, go down a mile, walk across the border, and walk back again. Well, try that when it's 25 below and when the roads are covered with snow that's in a drift because of the wind. We've had people have actually had to lose fingers and hands and their toes because they weren't prepared for it, wandered across the border, and are now showing up as an immigrant in Canada, a refugee in Canada. That has the potential to sort of really cause some really challenging questions for Canada about how generous we are, how open our borders are going to be. We're a country of immigrants except for First Nations people and Métis and Inuit people, but I think we're about to discover we're really not.
Really uncertain times ahead. Ken Coates, thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been fascinating. Now, you're about to give your lecture. Tell us where people can access it after you've given it. Is it on a website?
We'll be up on the website here at the University of Canberra, and it'll be up on my personal website when they send me the information. So I hope people will follow up. It's a very important topic, and it's one of those topics where I can't pretend to have the answers, but I can surely give you a bunch of questions.
And they're interesting ones too. That's all for our podcast today from The Conversation. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again soon. Goodbye for now. I'm Michelle Bratton.